Deborah Fisher was part of the pioneering team in this discipline when the first discoveries were announced and followed up. And since then, she's become a pioneer in her own right. She's contributed quite a bit to our basic understanding of these exoplanets. And she's also concentrated quite a bit on teaching. And so I hope you'll recognize in her not only a great scientist, but a great communicator. Today, she's is going to grace us with a talk on following up on Alan's talk, which was a broader survey on searching for Earths in the Alpha Centauri system.
Right. Deborah. Okay, thank you. Well, thanks especially to Alan for setting everything up so nicely, and I'm really kind of astonished at the observer-theorist rivalry that he's set up. But let's see how this goes. Anyway, so I'm an observer. I like to really visualize things. And so, you know, when there are questions like, what's the time scale of migration? Now I'm getting nervous. But anyway, I wanted to give you something to take back for your students as well. And I wanted to give you a little perspective. I know that not all of you teach astronomy. Some teach physics and math classes as well. And so as we talk about extrasolar planets, it's so easy to like move on and discuss and throw out numbers like 5 Jupiter masses and 3 AUs without really having a good gut feeling for what those numbers mean. So that's what I'd kind of like to give to you and to my students. Of course, in our solar system, we've got 8 planets, lots of rocky debris, which are, you know, that you might call the terrestrial planets, rocky debris, and asteroids. Most of the planets have moons, interestingly, and most of these planets are on at least nearly circular orbits, and only one of the planets seems to be inhabited. And then putting this on the scale of the rocky planets, just throwing them all up, you can see that Venus is our near sort of sister, a sibling planet, nearly the same mass, and I am pretty sure that you'll hear from Jim Casting some interesting discussion about why it is that these three planets took such different evolutionary courses in our solar system, and only one bears life now. And then also, just to give you some numbers, Jupiter is roughly 300 times the mass of the Earth. Saturn is a third that, 95 Earth masses, Uranus 14 Earth masses, and Neptune 17 Earth masses. So now you have a more, I hope, qualitative, quantitative sense to go along with the discussion. One of the things that I like to do with students from kindergarten to fifth grade, and I still like to do this because I find it astonishing, is to think about the scale of the solar system. So we can do whatever we want to put up, you know, pictures, and here's the diameter of this planet compared to that planet. But when you really think about the vastness of our solar system and how much empty space there is, to me, I find it quite staggering. And so one handy thing, way to scale up the solar system is to put things in terms of, in units of the radius of the sun. So it turns out that scale to solar radii, you know, if we say this, the sun is a half a meter, okay, then the Earth is about a half of a centimeter scale. It's about 1/100 that size. Okay, so the coffee bean Earth picture. All right, and then the distance between the Earth's sun is about 100 meters, so 100 giant steps. And so here's the coffee bean Earth, okay, picture. And here's the sun, which I tried to imagine sitting in the back of the room. How big would half a meter be? And I missed, unfortunately. But if this was a half a meter in diameter, okay, something more like that, a circle more like that in diameter, then I would take that coffee bean Earth, right, and I would take 100 giant steps. And so just for one second, think about where that would put me, you know, outside this room. So this incredible, you know, empty sort of space that in our solar system. And, you know, the first time I did this with the fifth grade class and they're running across the playground, I thought, wow, you know, I learned these numbers when I got my PhD, and, you know, I knew them, but I never had this gut feeling for how empty it is, and why aren't there more planets in our solar system, for example? And that's one of the things that I want to talk about today. So if you look at the cartoon sketch of our solar system, you know, everything lies in a plane, and, you know, the outer planets stretch out. So now here are the inner planets, and the outer planets go way out here. About Uranus is something like halfway out in our solar system, depending on how you want to define the end of our solar system. And so you might ask, so are these planets, you know, are these stable planets in vast open spaces? Could you have dropped more planets in our solar system? You know, why are they all on circular orbits except for Pluto, of course, which has been rejected as a planet? And I'm going to come back to these questions when I talk about one of the multiple planet systems that we found. So for now, just hold these, you know, these characteristics of our solar system in your mind. And then, of course, remember that if you scale, compare the size of the planets to the sun, again, the Earth being about 1/100 the diameter of the sun. Okay, so that's all for the right through middle school review. And then our sun appears to be just a completely unremarkable star. Maybe not completely typical. The most common stars in our galaxy are lower mass stars. So nature makes, you know, build very massive stars very infrequently, and there are lots of little, tiny, smaller stars, about half the size of our sun, half the mass of our sun. So our sun's, but in any case, our sun's pretty unremarkable. It's like millions of other stars in our galaxy. And then, of course, you've seen this image of the Hubble Deep Field, which shows, you know, in a tiny square of the sky, part of the sky, you know, something like 10,000 galaxies. So there are trillions of galaxies in our universe, okay, each one harboring billions of stars in itself. Okay, so that's the background. And then, as Alan said, the field really began in 1995 when the first extrasolar planet was discovered. So we figured, we thought there would be planets around other stars, but I still remember in sort of 1993 people saying, isn't it a little odd that we haven't found any planets yet? You know, maybe they really don't exist. Maybe we're really it. That's it. And since that time, the number of planets that we've detected has grown, and this plot shows the mass of the planets and then the numbers, so it's a histogram scale. And here we are in 2009, okay, with something like 412, well, no, more than 400, almost 500, we're approaching 500 planets that have been identified around nearby stars. And one of the interesting characteristics is that these guys are the easiest to find, the most massive planets, right? They induce the largest signals. And these are the most difficult planets to find, and yet they're the most common, clearly the most common, against all of our observational biases, which I thought Alan nicely portrayed as a kind of curtain over what we can't see, right? We just have to keep pushing that curtain back. So this tells us something really important about planet formation, right? Just this plot alone. So if you take a graph like this and think about it, it means that nature's not forming these 10 Jupiter mass planets very often. And that in the same way that the massive stars are rare, the very massive planets are also rare. Making smaller things is probably easier. So Ellen went through the different detection techniques, and I'll focus mostly on one technique, which is the one that I use. It's the Doppler technique. And the idea is that, well, light is a wave, right? You all teach this in your physics classes, I'm sure. And if you have a source that's moving toward you or away from you, there's a shift in the frequency of that wave. And then the way that I like to, again, explain it so that it's kind of visceral is that, you know, imagine that you're on a boat and the waves, you know, you're just sitting there with no motor on and the waves are kind of going by. And then you turn the motor on in your boat and you drive, you know, into the waves. Then you hit the waves more often. And then you turn your boat around and you drive in the direction that the waves are going. And now you hit the waves less often, less frequently. So light is a wave. Light also, when an object like a star or is moving toward us or away from us, then the light becomes blue shifted or red shifted as we look at it. So literally, if you could take a star and make it go fast enough, it would change color, okay? It would go from being, say, a blue star towards being a red star if it could go fast enough because of the Doppler effect. Most of the velocities of nearby stars in our galaxies are much smaller than that. And so we see not a shift in the whole color of the star, But what we do see is a shift in the absorption lines in the star. So in this spectrum of a star, when I go to the observatory, this is what a star looks like to me. It's not one of those little round white dots. It's literally a spectrum, and very much like a rainbow, right? Except this rainbow is something like 10 feet long physically. And so in the optics of our spectrometer, we chop up that rainbow and we stack the light on a CCD detector. And so now what you see is not a continuous smooth wavelengths of light from the star, but there are these, it's kind of ratty looking, there are these missing wavelengths of light right here. There's those two lines are caused by absorption of starlight from the sodium that's in the atmosphere of the star. In fact, this is the spectrum of our sun. Up here, hydrogen. Here, magnesium. Okay, and each one of these lines can be identified like this. Most of them are actually iron lines, not because the sun is mostly iron, but because there are lots of transitions for iron at optical wavelengths. So what we see is now as the star comes toward us or goes away from us, that these lines are shifted a little bit relative to the rest wavelengths. And that's because of the Doppler effect. So again, the cartoon sketch of this. Let's see, I don't know what's going to happen. Yeah, I was afraid of that. So it's not running. There we go. Okay. Shows that a star orbiting a common center of mass, and you see this very exaggerated sort of shift in the spectral lines. And so we go to the observatory, and we measure night after night, year after year, until we see one complete period. Okay? The lines shift back and forth, one full orbit of the star. And that's what we measure. Now, when you look at this, it looks pretty easy, right? Like, you could set this up in your lab. But in fact, the shifts that we're measuring, you know, as Alan said, the Jupiter induces a reflex velocity in the sun of something like 12 or 13 meters per second. Okay, and so this causes a shift in a stellar line, which is a couple of pixels wide on a CCD detector. That's about 1/1000th of a pixel shift, okay? And so if you want to find even smaller planets, then that shift goes down to 1/10,000th or 1/100,000th. All right, we're going from shifts that are hundreds of molecules in our silicon detector to looking for shifts that are a few molecules in our silicon detector. And that gets to be quite difficult because, yeah, it is. Okay, so I checked in the back of the room because Alan reminded me that during my talk the planet count was ticking by, and indeed I had to update my slide. So 412 is the current count for this technique, the Doppler technique. The number of planets that have been found by transiting method is something like 71 now, and we really expect that Kepler is going to roll out huge numbers of transiting planets in the next year or two. The microlensing folks have found about a dozen exoplanets. And someone asked the question, what would our, okay, if we were using a technique, we lived on another star like, say, Alpha Centauri, and we had a telescope and a spectrograph and we were looking at the sun, what would we see? Which of the planets would we see with our current techniques? And as Alan said, if the planets were perfectly aligned in a plane, right, along our line of sight, then we could hope to pick up some transits. If we were using the spectrometer that I use, say, radial velocity measurements at Lick Observatory in California, then we might expect to see a couple of wobbles. So here's the velocity of the sun with time. And I plotted two theoretical curves. All right, theory is good. And so the theoretical curves have an amplitude of about, you know, 12-ish meters per second and a period of about 12 years for the blue curve, and that's from Jupiter. Okay, so that's the wobble we would expect in the sun if we were looking at the sun more or less, you know, in the plane of the planets. Then if we look for a longer time, we would see that these velocities would be modulated by a longer period trend, the red dashed line, which has an amplitude of only of less than 3 meters a second and an orbital period of about 30 years. And that, of course, is from Saturn. And so this is the great thing for these multiple planet systems. The reason that we can disentangle each of the signals from each of the planets is that they have different orbital periods, okay? Because of Kepler's law, the planets that are further out take longer to go around. And so they show up in a Fourier analysis with different frequencies. Now, I put onto the theoretical curve the actual observational data, which is not so pretty, right? And I think you'd be hard-pressed looking at this to say you could detect Saturn. Even if you, all right, observe for 70 years, it would be hard. You would clearly see Jupiter. But in fact, our mathematical analysis pulls out the second signal quite easily. So it's not, we can't see it by eye very well, but it's there. And then Ellen talked about this, the curtain in our data. And in fact, our projects have been going on since, you know, sort of the mid-1990s. So we have something like 15 years of data. And so if you were observing this, the star, the sun from Alpha Centauri for something like 15 years, this is all you'd see. All right, and so that's why it gets complicated to understand or to detect the things that are far away, and of course the things that are small, because they induce a smaller velocity in the star. Okay, so now that you've had the lesson in how to find exoplanets, right, quiz time, how many planets are orbiting this star? Anyone want to hazard a guess? More than one is a really good answer, right? And you can see that there's something high frequency, short period going on. But you can also see by eye this kind of a thing going on, right? And if you again carry out the mathematical analysis, which is something that I did in 1999 for this system, then you find that, in fact, there are three planets there. And this was a bit of a surprise. We knew early on, Jeff Marcy and Paul Butler had found the closest planet in a four-ish day orbit, 4.671 days, and they could see the long period trend in the same way that you might see, you know, the sun beginning a long period trend because of Saturn, but that and this outer orbit closed when I began to model the data, and then the surprise was that there was one more planet that was nestled in there, actually. And so this is the star Upsilon Andromeda, and it was the first time that we had found a multiple planet system. And it was a little bit of a surprise. I remember people saying, wait, no, this is not right. We found a dozen single planets around stars, okay? Next, we should be finding double planet systems. Then we should find, right, it should go in some kind of an order. But, you know, this is what nature dealt. And this was an amazing system because at the time that we found it, I began to learn more about our own solar system and the stability of the planets in our own solar system. And in fact, these vast empty spaces are not so, right, empty as you might imagine. If you try to, in the scale model of the solar system, to drop another little, you know, peppercorn or coffee bean planet in the solar system, the other planets take notice, they're gravitationally perturbed, and the whole system becomes chaotic. So, in fact, Jack Lissauer at MIT and Jacques Lascar in Paris have both run models on our solar system, which suggests that we're on the verge of stability, okay? And that means something important in terms of planet formation. I think that means that we start out in the story of planet formation building hundreds or thousands of planetesimals, right? And they compete for gravitationally stable niches and settle into this environment that's, you know, stable, but not exactly empty. Okay, and so this was the interesting parallel with this system, Upsilon Andromeda, because the theorists began to model the system, and they tried dropping moon-sized particles in, and the whole system fell apart. So it showed that this was a system that, at least in the inner part, seemed to be dynamically full of planets, okay, a characteristic which we share in our own solar system, and which I think is profoundly important when you ask the question, Do you think there are stars that don't have planets, as one of you asked? And Alan said, you know, you've got to do that. I think you have to get rid of the planets. So planet formation is just this natural consequence of star formation, and probably most stars form. So it turns out that these multiple planet systems aren't just an odd curiosity. Something like 30%, 50%, we actually empirically observe additional planets in the system. And knowing how easy it is to hide planets, right, it wouldn't be a surprise if, in fact, most solar systems were not only had a planet, but had multi-planet architectures. So this was kind of a cute story, because when this system was found, here's the star, okay, the artist's rendition by Lynette Cook, the star with the inner planet, the first one found by Marcy and Butler, the outer planet, which we found, and then the surprise inner, you know, in-between planet. And so when the story was published in 1999, a class of fourth graders sent me a letter, and they said, you know, we've been studying astronomy in our class, building, you know, scale models of the solar system, and our teacher brought in this story about Upsilon Andromeda, and so we wondered if you'd named any of the planets yet, because, of course, they had suggestions. And they they thought that the outer planet, which was four times the mass of our Jupiter, should be Forpiter, which was a great name, right? It's perfect. And then this one, which is two times the mass of our Jupiter, Tupiter, of course. And then the little one that orbits in just 4 days is only something like 3/4 the mass of our Jupiter, which would make it how many Earth masses? Test time. 3/4 of 300-ish, you know. So it's still, right, pretty big. So they named that one Dinky anyway. And those names kind of stuck with some history. In any case, lots of planets were being found in the 1990s, and as Alan said, I think people were skeptical about the interpretation, because they're unseen planets. They remain unseen, except we did know that 1 in 10 of the close planets would transit, and indeed, in 1999, as described, HD 209458 transited across the face of its host star at exactly the time predicted by the radial velocity measurements. The starlight dimmed ever so slightly, confirming the Doppler observations from a new perspective. And so I think that's a theme that we all appreciate and think is important, that there are many different techniques that are beginning to intrude on the parameter space of extrasolar planets in different ways and build together, piece together a coherent picture of what kind of architectures exist. So I took out all my slides on the techniques because they were so well described. But I wonder, I find myself wondering, you know, as Alan said, the thing we really are interested in is whether or not there are other Earths. And there are good reasons to think about that. So of these techniques, microlensing, which has found 10 planets, transits with Kepler, so far 5, many more to come, transits with ground-based telescopes, about 66 planets, Doppler observations, 412, imaging, something like 11 planets. How many of these techniques can find Earths? And which of the techniques will find many Earths? Because what we care about is finding planets that show some sign of life, right? And we can probably bet that not every one of these Earths are going to show some sign of life. And so as just a number to throw out there, I would say we want to find 100 Earths, all right? We're still trying to find the first, you know, real Earth, but we want to find 100 so that we can really begin a systematic survey and figure out how often some kind of life might exist on these planets. We all, in my field, have considered pretty hard whether or not we might be able to find Earths with the Doppler technique. And it's a non-trivial exercise. But somebody's got to do it, right? We're trying to literally beat down the noise. And so to do this in the most efficient way possible, although it's kind of amusing what efficient means in this field, we went to the brightest, very brightest star, Alpha Centauri A and B, okay? A binary star system, right? But the stars are zeroth magnitude. I mean, everybody in the southern hemisphere looks up and sees Alpha Cent A and B, almost like we see Jupiter in the sky, you know, incredibly bright. And so here's, and it has a long history because it's so close of being observed. The orbit is of the two-star system, binary star system, is well known. And here's the configuration. So here's the orbit projected into the plane of the sky. And from 1990 to 1910 to 2010, where we are right now, this shows the orbit of the second star, B, as seen from the first star, A. All right, so the orbit of the binary star system is about 80 years. And at closest approach, they come within about 12 AUs of each other. All right, so that's pretty close. A little crazy, maybe, for looking for planets. So, however, people have run simulations, theorists have run simulations, showing that if planets exist around either A or B, there actually is a zone that's about 2 AUs wide, 1 AU being the Earth-Sun distance, okay, about 2 AUs wide around either star. I kind of actually photoshopped that in here as these little green halos around the stars. Okay, so if there are planets within the little green halos, again, which is almost out to Mars's orbit in our solar system, they're actually dynamically stable. They survive. And so we ran some simulations. Greg Laughlin with his student Javier Agundis ran simulations of planet formation and detectability for Alpha Cent A and B before we started the project. And they started out with what in a science talk I would say is a John Chambers-like simulation. John Chambers did this work, I think, when he was at DTM, where Alan is, and put in hundreds of little moon-sized particles, okay, in the simulation. And now, so kids get this because, right, Sim City, Sim, all the different Sim games, that you've got these planets stretched out here, and now you let them go. And what they feel is the gravity of the star that they're orbiting and the gravitational interaction of the other planets. So in your simulation, if two of these objects get close enough together, you just make them stick. Okay, we don't really follow the thermodynamics of the merger. You just simply empirically make them stick. And so what happens is that some of these small particles get tossed out of the star system, some fall into the star, and others merge to form larger planets. So you can see the evolution from the beginning at 0 million years in the first panel to 10 million years, 20 million years, and down here to 200 million years. When we end up with something that actually looks a bit like the Earth, I think the big dot, the dot size is scaled to the mass of the planet, and the big dot is something like a little more than one Earth mass, 1.1 Earth masses. And so you see these other arrangements. Now, this is one simulation. There were hundreds of others. This process of planet formation is chaotic. If you change the velocity vector of one of those particles in the beginning, you end up with something that's different at the end. And I think that's really what's going on in planet formation. So in any case, we think it's reasonable that you could end up with, you know, something like a solar system, and that those planets would survive for billions of years in orbit around Alpha Centauri A or B. So now what would it take to detect them? Because we've looked, we know that there aren't any Jupiters there aren't any Saturns there, okay? And so the only thing we're looking for are really these little Earth-like planets from sort of Mars mass to Earth mass planets. And so we ran some simulations that assumed bad weather, mechanical downtime, and so forth, and found that it would take 90,000 observations over with a precision of 3 meters a second, okay, to sort of beat down the noise floor so that we could get to something like a 2 centimeter per second precision, okay, in the Fourier transform. So now this is something with 3 meter error bars that we're never going to see, you know, a 2 centimeter or 10 centimeter signal, which is what we're trying to find, all right, but it will be buried there in the noise if and only if the noise sources from the star are what we would call white, right? They don't have some frequency signal themselves. And that might not be the case. We know that stars, vibrate, right? Corot and Kepler are following the astroseismology of the stars. But most stars like Alphas and A and B, will have pulsation periods that are 5 minutes. So with 90,000 observations, we're going to plow right over that. That's not a worry. But are there other noise sources in the surface of the star that have periods of, you know, months? If that's the case, then we're in trouble. Or is there something in our instrument, right, that's going to cause us trouble? And so for all these reasons, this project has been dubbed Project Longshot. I just hope and pray that I don't end up a Peter Van de Kamp in somebody's story, right? Right, the ultimate theorist's revenge, right? But you know, I think it's something that we have to do, not just because it would be exciting to find the planets, but because we're really trying to understand the noise sources in our Doppler technique. We're really trying to figure out how well we can average down noise to find really small, low-mass planets. And, you know, if the answer is no problem, you can do it with 100,000 observations of Alpha Centauri, then we'd think about building a bigger I'm using a 1.5-meter telescope at Cerro Tololo. We build a bigger telescope, dedicate it to Doppler planet searches, right, and just pound away here on Earth where we've got hundreds of years to follow these stars and beat down the noise. So it would be a tractable technique then that would be pretty thrifty when you compare it with the several billion-dollar missions anyway that were described by Alan. So the challenges are many and profound. The one thing, as I said, that I worry about are velocity noise sources from the surface of the star. So here are two pictures of the sun, one taken at ultraviolet wavelength bands and the other at visible bands. And you can see that, at least in the ultraviolet, the sun has a lot of velocity fields, right? There are flares and flows on the surface of the sun that are moving at speeds of kilometers a second. And we're trying to find a dynamical shift in the center of mass that's centimeters per second. So that's what makes this hard, one thing that makes this hard. My perspective is that in 1997, people were getting sort of, you know, 3, 5, 10 meter per second precision, then I would ask people, well, why? Why can't we do better? And the answer was, oh, we're hitting the floor of the stellar noise, right? So we're not going to do better than that because it's the star. And then, you know, we got to 2 to 3 meters a second, and then the stellar noise of the star was 2 to 3 meters a second. And then we got to, you know, 1 meter a second, and some people are doing below that, and they say the reason they're not doing better is because they've hit the floor of the stellar noise. And so it would be really good to push past the floor of the stellar noise, right, and see what the stellar noise really looks like. So I'm not sure we can do it, but we're certainly trying. And we're building, in fact, a new spectrograph, which is going to be commissioned in December, November, December of this year, which will be much better than the instrument we're using right now. I'll talk more about that. Okay, and the other interesting thing is that if you look at this, right, in ultraviolet, things are bad. There's a lot of, the lines are moving pretty fast. At visible wavelengths, it's smooth. In the red or wavelengths, the star is even more, looks even more homogeneous because the contrast between the spots and the photosphere of the star go way down the redder you go. Okay, so high contrast, okay, low contrast, even lower contrast at redder wavelengths. So we're also thinking about how we could, extend our analysis to encompass redder wavelengths, and we might see a difference there that's caused by spots versus no spots. The other challenge is theorists, because they tell me that, okay, you can run the dynamical simulations, all right, and it's true that the planets will survive, but you could have never formed them in the first place. And the reason is that when the picture that we have is that as the star is forming, it first collapses from this giant cold cloud of molecular gas and dust, settles down into a disk, and all the material in the star actually flows through this disk towards the central gravitational well, and then continues to pile up there until the central object becomes a star. It achieves high enough mass that the pressure at the core of this object can fuse hydrogen and provide some hydrostatic equilibrium, push back on the force of gravity. And then the stuff that's left behind is the debris disk, right, where the planets form. And so this is why all the planets in our solar system are in a plane, because they started out this way, and they inherited that geometry. Okay, but now if you take, people think something like 100 AUs perhaps, right? And if we take a second star and plop it down so that at closest approach, it comes within 11 AUs of the other star, well, that's gotta have a big impact on the disk. And so every time I would submit my NSF proposal to look for planets in around Alpha Centauri A and B, then Philippe Thébault, actually, who is a theorist, would say, publish a paper that, you know, planets could never form around Alpha Centauri A. Planets could never form around Alpha Centauri B. There's no animosity, but, right? You heard it from the master. So, in fact, we have counterexamples where planets have been found in binary systems that are as close as Alpha Centauri A and B. And they're not just little garbage planets like Earth, right? Little rocky debris, whatever. They're big gas giant planets. So that's, I think, fairly impressive. I think another challenge is that we're using a vintage spectrometer. When we started the project, we knew exactly what star we wanted for all sorts of reasons that I could discuss, but Alpha Centauri A and B are visible in the southern hemisphere, and we had to go south. So we found a telescope that was just about to be shut down, the Sarah-Tololo 1.5 meter telescope, and we sort of resurrected this old spectrometer that had been retired, decommissioned in fact, and fiber fed it, and we've been using this spectrometer for the last 2 years to collect our data. So that's why we have NSF, actually MRI, stimulus funding to build the new spectrometer that will replace this one soon, we hope. Okay, so anyway, I think this is a long shot, but somebody has to do this. We need to understand what the floor of the velocity data are. And so here you can see we are up at the observatory trying to put things together and make this old instrument work, building all of the parts that we need for precision Doppler work. And, you know, every morning, I get an email with, here are your 500 observations from last night. So we have 200 nights of telescope time a year on this little 1.5 meter telescope, and we're running all night every night that the two stars are up, trying to really beat down, again, the noise sources in the star. And so the velocity measurements are streaming out. We see this beautiful, you know, binary orbit in the primary star. And now the question is, and it's going to take a couple more years, to find out whether or not in this band of velocity measurements that we have, we're able to mathematically extract a tiny little 10 or 20 centimeter signal. So I call it long shot. You know, Frank Drake estimated that his chances of finding extraterrestrial signals were somewhere between 25% and 1 in a million. Okay. So I have tenure now, so I can do this. Something to be said. And so I just want to end by thanking many people who have helped with really what's an overwhelming task, from the telescope operators to my colleagues and support scientists and students have been amazing. So I'll just open for questions now.
presentation. Thanks. We'll open the floor for questions. Yes.
How far down into the infrared can your CCD detect photons?
To about 9,000 angstroms. 9,000 angstroms. So not into the near infrared. And the problem, there are spectral lines. The problem is that then you start to hit the telluric lines. So, you know, we use this iodine cell, which I didn't talk about, but the way that we measure shifts in the stellar lines to, you know, a thousandth of a pixel are because we imprint thousands of absorption lines from an iodine cell right into each spectrum that we take. And that spectrum, that iodine, is fixed in our lab, and we're looking for the stellar lines to shift back and forth with respect to it. But we're also looking through another kind of a iodine cell, and it's our atmosphere. It's not iodine, of course, but it's telluric lines, OH lines, and so forth. And they become very dense as you go to infrared wavelengths. So we're trying to stay away from that.
When you were talking about the stability of the solar systems, that it is on the verge of being stable, if we throw some moonlight masses, they fly apart. Are you referring to our solar system?
Or? Yes, our solar system, right. And so in something like 4 billion years, Jim Casting will tell you we're going to get into trouble far before that, before 4 billion years. But in something like 4 billion years, the simulations have shown that one of the planets in our solar system will probably be ejected. I remember if it's Mercury or Mars. I can't remember.
If I remember correctly, the Centauri system has a third star.
Yeah, Proxima. That's right.
And so A and B, I think, are relatively close to the solar mass of our sun, and Proxima is like 0.2 or something like that.
Right.
Do you eliminate your search for Proxima because it's so small, or is it just that
it's too faint?
Yeah,
it's an M dwarf. It's ninth magnitude. Well, it's way too faint, and so we could never get the signal that we need, right, to get 90,000 observations. It's a race to get, you know, so many observations, and I can get 500 observations a night on Alpha Centauri A, which is, you know, the brightest star. 300 on Alpha Cent B, and you know, one or two on Proxima. So Proxima gets dumped. Yeah.
I seem to remember a law called Bode's Law, where planets' positions were predicted. Right. Is there any chance of is that a valid law, first of all? And is there any chance of seeing that when you look at this three-planet system?
So Bode's Law was revisited with the Upsilon Andromeda system, and people have talked about it. I think what we see going on is, you know, it might empirically describe our solar system, but it's not a universal law. What we understand now is a lot more sophisticated, that this whole process of planet formation is very chaotic, and you just end up with some natural separation, all right? If the planets weren't separated by a certain amount, which scales with their mass and distance from the sun, then they would be in unstable orbits, and they wouldn't survive. So the things that survive are forced to be in a kind of natural spacing. And that's Bode's Law, observed that. But it's not in itself a fundamental law.
Just in that context, it's interesting to know that there's a journal called Icarus which refuses to accept any papers which are purport to explain Bode's Law. So it's not something which theorists consider seriously, unfortunately, these days. It really seems to be just a chance that our solar system fits that law so well.
Do we know, maybe from photometry, about the sunspot cycle of these stars, that they don't hit the 4 or 5 years? Do we know the rotational periods? And do we know if their rotational axes are closely aligned with their orbital?
Right, good question. So let's see. So the stars have been observed photometrically for a long time. One of the issues is that because these stars are so blazingly bright in the sky, the precision photometry is really good, but it's a little more difficult because you need to have a comparison star so that you can measure changes, and there aren't any good comparison stars except Alpha Centauri A and B themselves. So you can do relative photometry on them, and it's good. Let's see, your second question. We know the rotation of the stars. We measure the rotation period the broadening of the spectral lines. And it's consistent with the stellar spin axis being perpendicular to the equatorial plane of the binary star orbit. And all of the simulations that were run for planets, interestingly, forced the planets to be in the plane, right? The planets don't survive unless they're nearly in the plane of the binary star orbit. And that's a key thing, because that binary star orbit is oriented like that, okay? And so we're going to get most of the M sine I, we're going to get most of the mass of the planet. That was another driver for the project.
Deborah, there are these things called laser combs that the physicists have been working on that might eventually replace the iodine cells,
right,
and whatnot. Is there a chance that those things will allow us to get more precise measurements?
Yeah, indeed. I have an NSF proposal in for a laser frequency comb. And what I want to do, working with people at Harvard and MIT who have been pioneering this, but also in Colorado, is actually impose a laser frequency comb so the iodine lines go from 500 nanometers to 600 nanometers. If I can put a laser frequency comb in from 600 to 700 nanometers, then I've got some prediction, right, on star spot behavior, and I've extended the wavelength coverage, and yeah, it's going to be, I think it's fantastic and very exciting, and also probably 5 years away, but yeah.
So which do you want to do more? Do you want to find a planet around these stars, or do you want to lower the stellar interference?
Wow, that is a really good
question. You can only do one.
You're looking deep into my soul. Okay, if the planets are really there, I want to find them. I don't want to be fooled. Oh my God, what's the movie? Avatar just came out, right? And James Cameron put these gas giant planets around Alpha Centauri A. I mean, the reporters were all calling, and we said, no, you know, that one doesn't exist. So, no, we want to find them because, look, if we find Earth-like planets around our nearest neighbor, that's going to completely change the face and the focus of NASA. I seriously believe that, you know, once we do that, I don't have my cell phone with me, but that, you know, we'll be engineering these little cell phone-sized, you know, robotic spacecraft to go to the Alpha Centauri system, you know, maybe traveling 1/100th the speed of light. I don't care. That's only 400 years, right? 10% the speed of light gets you there in 40 years, and we can have a hope of maybe, you know, seeing this, is actually seeing our nearest neighbors. So it's going to be really important.
Just out of curiosity, do you have the newest NASA app that shows the sun?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I'll get it.
A sun that feeds directly onto your phone. Yeah, a lot of my
students
have that.
Okay, I'll have my 16-year-old son download that for me. Good.
I got it.
Most of your inferences and results are based on a technique, so they are limited and depends on the sensitivity of the technique. How can you draw conclusions that the nature behaves in a manner it does based on the results that are technique specific?
So the question, how can we tell that nature behaves as it does based on, okay, so when you say nature behaves, what do you mean? The planet mass distribution or the? Oh, sure, absolutely, absolutely. So whatever's behind the curtain, you're right, it's completely unseen. And we have to be really careful about that, that we don't know that we're sure, you know, that we say we don't know that. But we're trying to erode, you know, chip away at the problem, sort of one planet at a time, and bringing in different techniques to look at things from different perspectives, so that we can just, this is the beginning. You're seeing the birth of a new science. So, yeah, there's a lot of growing pains, and there's a lot of growth still to happen. Does that help or answer your question? Okay.
I think I'm up. Okay. I've always wondered, and I've never really been able to find any information on this, what exactly, in your opinion, caused, let's say, our solar system, the giant molecular cloud, to start the rotation?
Oh, yeah. Oh, conservation of angular momentum.
I understand it, but yeah. What is it that gave the angular momentum to the
right? Okay. Okay. Cloud. So in the beginning, right? Oh God, I said that once. I was at the Vatican Observatory and I gave a talk and I said, in the beginning, and I realized, oh. Okay, so, but yeah, you know, when you start out with this cold molecular cloud, the particles aren't just sitting there, right? Everything has some kinetic energy. And so if you built up a velocity vector map of all of the particles in the cloud, you would see that on average, some direction, it doesn't perfectly average out. It's not completely zero when you add up all the velocity vectors. And so now as it begins to collapse, then there's some net angular momentum from the cloud that begins to spin up because you're decreasing the radius of the cloud.
It's not caused by, for example, some outside catastrophic sort of event or some impulse from somewhere.
Right, right. So it could be absolutely that what starts you have to in this cloud, because the cloud's existed for a long time as just a cloud, right? So maybe what you're saying is what triggers it to stop being a cloud and start collapsing. And that's that you end up with some region that's dense enough, right? It's called the Jeans criteria, where you have a high enough density that it can actually begin to collapse under its own self-gravity. And that could indeed be triggered by a passing star, right, which just ripples the density through the cloud a little bit. Or, yeah. Theorists know better than I.
Yeah, I'm wondering if there's another, you know, sort of call it, well, we'll say a helpful analog to what you're doing. If you got into the infrared and just looked at dust distributions,
right,
might you see magnetism, maybe knots of magnetism associated, you know, in between these two binaries that might indicate something? I was just wondering about that.
Okay, well, these two binaries are a bit of a problem because they are so bright. It makes it difficult to actually look at them and disentangle the point spread function of the instrument and so forth. So it's challenging for imaging. But there are, of course, a lot of observations. One of the teachers here has a Spitzer project that she told me about. So observations looking in the infrared for dust around stars. Because the dust that we see around stars that are like the age of our sun is not primordial dust. It's not dust that from that protoplanetary disk. It's dust that that came into existence because objects like comets and asteroids collide. And when they collide, they break apart and they form this dust. That dust has some lifetime and it drains into the star, so it has to be replenished. So when you see dust around like mature stars, normal adult stars, it means that there's something there that's colliding and generating that dust. And that is a signature of planets. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to comment on the angular momentum of the cloud. The cloud is in the galaxy, and the galaxy is rotating, so it's virtually impossible for the cloud not to have angular momentum to begin with.
Right.
Of course, then you get back to why is the galaxy rotating?
Right.
Other questions? Let's thank Deborah once again for one.
I now want to reintroduce Marty.